What do you want to talk about? What's a good cold open?
Diet Coke addiction.
You were at the mothership.
I was. It's yeah. So great. Yeah. Yeah, he has designed one hell of a club. I was in the Fat Man, which is the big room for Joe Rogan and friends.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a bad seat in that house. It's absolutely gorgeous.
What's the capacity?
I don't know, but I would guess close to 300.
Okay.
Just from...
How high are the ceilings?
It's not one of those like low situations. It was a good vibe. It's
okay.
It felt really comfortable. I felt like I was in the back because we got the VIP booths, which are actually in the back of them.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like I could see everything. I was close enough to the comedians. Like there's not a bad seat in there. And I can't imagine how much better it's going to be in the little room considering the big room was great.
My favorite comedy club aesthetic is this was really big in the 80s when Rodney Dangerfield was doing cocaine here, and we've changed nothing since then. That's my favorite. It's still like a lot of like kind of shabby velvet, like velvet with holes in it. Like I like places that have that aesthetic of like fallen, smoky, boozy grandeur.
You know, it has that because it's in the Ritz. It's in this old historic building. And so even though it is brand new, he modeled it out after the Comedy Store. So Mitzi's, which is named after the creator of the Comedy Store, that feels like the store. It's dark. It has this red lighting. It's kind of like got this smoky whiskey vibe to it. It's so cool. And it's tiny too. And then when you go into the comedy club, it feels like a smaller version of the main room. So you can tell where he got his inspiration from for sure. But yeah, it's already one of my favorite places.
A comic who got rich to just build the comedy club of your dreams,
headline
every night, and just book your friends.
Yeah.
He's living the dream.
That's
good. I job, mean, that guy.
Yeah.
And he's been incredible for the Austin comedy scene, like, which is sad because I haven't even applied myself that much to the Austin comedy scene. But like when I first moved here several years ago, there was one comedy club, and Austin was widely considered to be a good place to start or to retire to.
Yeah.
So if you were beginning stand up, there were like some good open mics, but you're gonna have to leave, go to New York or maybe Chicago or LA. But if you got big enough, you could retire here. And like now, there's like four or five comedy clubs.
It's kind
here.
Of kind of a destination city.
No, it's
people, largely because of Rogan.
Yeah, it's like it's we're kind of Chicago level now of like being up there. Like still not going to be New York, but like still like going to be a really big city.
Shane Gillis lives here now. He was one of the and friends in Joe Rogan and Friends.
Yeah.
So it was Tony Hinchcliffe, Shane Gillis. I know that Duncan Trussell lives here. Tim Dillon, like the Tom Segura, Christina P. Like there's so many people. And so when we saw Joe Rogan and Friends, I was like, I knew that I had already seen Rogan's act, but I was like, just for the friends, let's go. And Shane Gillis was so good. It was the first
He's
time
hilarious.
I've ever seen him. He was so funny. He warned us when he got up. He was like, this is new stuff. It's not going to be funny. And he absolutely murdered. So I have a new favorite thing to do here in Austin. And what's great is they don't allow resale of the tickets. And so we got these tickets on Sunday. So when I lived here like 6 months ago, they had
everything
opened.
Was like sold out.
You
for
could
months.
Not get a ticket, even in the open mics. Like it was impossible. And we just kind of looked on Sunday night, like, let's see, my friends are in town. And on a Sunday we got tickets for the late show on Tuesday. But yeah, so now it's possible as an Austin resident to go, especially if you go last minute. So I'm really excited. I'm going to go that lot. It was a great spot.
Nice. Yeah.
Heaton, what is your mothership attendance plans? Please make them public.
Come with me.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Jen. Jen's going to get me tickets to Kill Tony.
Well,
which I later found out, I thought we were going to murder a guy named Tony, but that's not the case. It's actually called Kill Tony. No, we're
are you going to are you going to throw your name in the bowl?
In the hat? You're going to try and get a minute?
I don't. Maybe I'll think about it. Like the deal is you go up with 1 minute and then they grade you.
They judge you. Yeah.
Yeah. So you maybe. Put your name into. They basically put all the names in a bucket and they pull names. And so you go up, you do a minute, and then the panelists, which always includes Brian Redband and Tony Hinchcliffe. They give you feedback and they also generally roast you.
Mm-hmm.
It's total chaos and great for new comedians.
I think I will watch. I will watch it once and then maybe do it. If
That's
I
a
can.
Good move.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You want to know what you're getting into.
Well, submit yourself to
I think there's some
ritual torture.
In general.
Because by the way, that's our business model is torturing you and making fun of you, but we do it for cash.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I get paid for this.
Yeah.
No, I do think there's a lot to be said for just making yourself uncomfortable regularly. I think making like jumping out of an airplane. That's an uncomfortable thing to do if you've never done it before. You're going to, like, I don't know, you don't do karaoke. You're going to go to karaoke. So I think doing things that are publicly embarrassing are good because they build up a tolerance to embarrassment, which I think is a recipe for success. That being said, maybe I'll just go enjoy it the first time and then come back the second time and see if there's some utility in it.
Pussy. Sounds like a good one. Good cop and bad cop here.
From Austin, Texas, I am Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jen Briney.
And I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We are going to be talking about Ukraine funding and the Biden administration's porky pitch for it. And Prince Harry suing the United Kingdom for security. We're just going to see what it sounds like.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not mentioning that we're in a new place recording. So there's going to be a few things that'll work themselves out.
We're not going to mention that the air conditioner just went on and it sounds like a 747 going through the
room. But I don't think that it picks up in the same way that it does in my room.
We're going to find out.
We'll cut this out. But yeah, no, let's focus. But it means that everybody gets to stay climatized, which I know for our friend Heaton is a good.
Just out of curiosity, when I came in, it said the thermostat was set for 75. Is that correct?
No, I put it down to 72.
Great, thank you. Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, good. Everybody's happy. Everybody's happy. 72 is a normal human range for all persons concerned. Yeah, great. Terrific. Yay, good show.
I probably should have turned it down lower. So it was freezing up here, and then we could.
That keeps people on their toes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want people being too comfy on these shows. You want them to be on edge.
Yes, you do. You do want them to be. You want them to make sure that they know their place. Let's talk about Ukraine, huh? Funding for Ukraine is hanging by a thread in the United States Congress. High-ranking members of the Ukrainian government, including President Zelensky, briefed Congress this week to sway them for more. Joe Biden's White House has specifically tried to pitch the hesitant GOP votes with a very, very interesting strategy, circulating a map of how much money would go to red and purple war production factories. Pennsylvania and Arizona are key beneficiaries of the Biden administration's military support, as revealed in a graphic shared on Capitol Hill. The graphic shows significant economic impacts of the 2022-2023 supplemental appropriations for Ukraine, with Pennsylvania receiving the highest investment at $2.364 billion for munitions and tactical vehicles, followed closely by Arizona with $2.259 billion. Overall, states have gained, according to this graphic, over $27 billion from these investments. President Biden, addressing resistance from some GOP members, emphasized the benefit of U.S. manufacturing during an Oval Office speech. He highlighted that military aid to Ukraine involves replenishing U.S. stockpiles with equipment made in America, like Patriot missiles and artillery shells, bolstering domestic production. However, the White House has faced challenges in convincing Congress, leading to a shift in messaging to highlight these economic benefits. Jen, can pork sway the skeptics?
Absolutely. First of all, I don't think there's that many skeptics. It seems like a small group on only the Republican side, but there seems to be tons of support for continuing to throw money at Ukraine, at least this year. The question is how long this is going to go on for and what the end game is. So I think this change in pitch, it's so goddamn cynical. But I mean, like, here's a quote from a recent hearing. This was the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, James O'Brien. And he was talking about how they want $45 billion for military aid for Ukraine. And he says, American equipment in Ukraine will be used to pay for American service people to support Ukraine and to pay for other countries to acquire American equipment after they provide equipment to Ukraine. So it's like they really are trying to say, this is going to make our companies money. So therefore, we're not really paying anything, because if our companies make money, then it goes into our tax base and we all benefit. I think that's so cynical, because it's not telling us what the goal is in Ukraine. It's not telling us how long we're going to have to keep this up. It's not telling us who's actually going to be fighting this war? Because they keep talking about this is going to be for the long haul. So they're asking for all this money right now. Like, how many more times are we going to do this? So the pitch being like, well, I mean, it costs us money, but not really, because it comes right back to us. I think it does have some sway, but it's not answering the bigger questions.
Well, right now, even the Mitt Romneys of the world are saying, I'm for this, but you need to pay a price. And the price right now is the border. You need to do some deal with the border, and we're not going to bend a lot on what we want from it. That's the moderate position from the Senate. Obviously, the House is, you know, its own, you know, bag of cereal there in terms of
as how, they say.
Yeah, as the saying goes, in terms of all that. But I do think that there is a Ukraine problem on the Democratic side. And I think that the fact that we have seen this level of cynicism of just being like, no, this is a jobs program, this is a pork program, is indicative of that. Heaton?
I think this is one of the first times where I've seen politicians just full out go, hey, the military industrial complex is a feature, not a bug. Here's how this works.
Yeah.
We're gonna take a bunch of tax dollars. Hold on now. Now we're gonna give it to contractors, but don't worry, we're gonna spread the contractors throughout your states so you get jobs. So they're literally describing the military industrial complex.
Yes.
And then Jen, the document you cited of hey, this is gonna cost some money, but don't worry, our firms will get more money through the public coffers. They're talking about concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. Like, these are like two things that regularly people rail against, that they're selling as features rather than a bug. I am disturbed by this on a couple of levels. Here's the Heaton plan. Let's not give large amounts of military aid to other countries until we have less homeless people than the state of Wyoming has people in it. I'm already kind of at that position. The bit that disturbs me here is that the people that are taking my position are usually the dickbag Republicans I don't like, but I think they've got a point. I assume this is the Freedom Caucus people.
America first, Heaton.
I think that we do have a lot of problems here. We've spent $106 billion, or is it $76 billion was the previous package. It'll come up to $106 billion if this passes through.
It's $70 billion from the United States. The EU has spent $90
billion. So we've already spent around $70 billion, and this is the next package. So we're looking at $106 billion to $110 billion. That's a lot of money.
Although, can I pause you right there? Because one thing that I found really interesting is that they're talking about how we're going to pay other countries to acquire American equipment after they provide equipment to Ukraine. And I'm wondering how much of that EU money is being like, oh, we gave military equipment to Ukraine. So how much of it is saying the EU is giving this money and then we, through other funds, give equipment to fill in? Like, is there a circle jerk of money that looks like it's coming from the EU, but it's actually coming from us because we're paying for the weapons? They're giving it to
Ukraine.
Based
on the quote you read, it sounds
almost
like
almost assuredly.
We are subsidizing other countries to purchase weapons from us to give to Ukraine, if I heard that correctly, which sounds very standard.
So when they tell us that we've spent $70 billion and the EU spent $90 billion, I'm like, yeah, but how much of that $90 billion actually came from us too? So even when we talk about these numbers, I don't believe they're fucking numbers.
I think that's very fair. I think there's a ton of money there. I also... without getting, you know, into the direct Ukraine-Russian conflict, which is a whole thing in and of itself, like, one of the other things going on right now is that the State Department, by its own admission and by leaked documents that came out from October, were that they are concerned about corruption going on in Ukraine in terms of where the money's going.
What?
I know, this is mind-blowing.
The one next to Russia, Ukraine.
The one next to Russia. And one
that Ukraine.
That Ukraine.
Corruption.
Yeah. And
at this time of year, located entirely in your kitchen.
And one small indication of this would be that Zelensky fired the defense minister because of corruption. He didn't say that the defense minister himself was corrupt, but he's presiding over a... That does not necessarily mean that you should not support Ukraine or give money to them, but it is one thing to consider how efficacious the money is that's going there.
Yeah.
At some point when we're going... Well, we're going to give, for every dollar we spend, we're going to give 25 cents of it to defense contractors. And we're going to give 25 cents of it to graft, and then 25 cents of it to general run-of-the-mill incompetency. At some point, that money is like, so we're getting 25 cents for every dollar we're spending, and it's $106 billion. I think that there are better uses for it. And I am concerned that America's funding a proxy war as a means to weaken Russia rather than as a means to liberate Ukraine, that there are cynical forces at work within our country that would not really mind so much if this were a protracted conflict because it's a cheap price tag for American taxpayers to try and weaken Russia. And I think that there will be a lot of collateral damage coming out of Ukraine as a result of this. And there's a very good chance it'll wind up exactly where it's been. They'll just have a peace process 5 years from now with another 50,000 dead people and a bunch of ruined villages. And what would we have done? We would have beefed up defense contractors this whole time. And that'll be the winner of it. So, yeah, I'd kind of rather keep that money at home.
Those are fancy words for I want Putin to win.
Well, and that's what we are getting accused of that. But it's like there's a difference between acknowledging the reality on the ground and rooting for Putin. Like, there's a difference between saying, like, I want Putin to get this Ukrainian territory and saying, oh, they did this whole counteroffensive and they got a couple cows in a field out of it. Like, the counteroffensive has failed by all measures. And yet the State Department is there telling Congress, Ukraine is winning this war. They've taken back half the territory that Russia got in February of 2022. And it's like, yeah, but none of that happened in 2023. Like, there's been
that all happened immediately. And now we are in a meat grinder stalemate.
Yeah. And they said that, to back up your point, the State Department said, and this is a rough paraphrase, but it says Ukraine is willing to fight because it's their territory. If we abandon them now, we'll have to fight Russia later. So this really is a proxy war with Russia. And we're just like, but Ukraine's willing to do it for us. So, like, let them. And so much of the hearing was talking about, you know, we need to get even during the war, we need to make it possible for the grain exports and the metal exports, and Halliburton and GE are ready to get in there. And they're making plans for the post-war period and exploring commercial opportunities. And so much of it was talking about these corporations that are hungry for the reconstruction, that, you know, every new town that's destroyed is a reconstruction opportunity for these companies. And that's the discussion being had in our Congress, not, well, a lot of people are dying. How do we stop this sooner than later? That is not the conversation. It's a money-making opportunity, and it's disgusting.
There's another element of this that I think gets lost, and that is we're not just sending weapons to Ukraine. We are sending weapons to Ukraine. That's the thing that I think is probably the most palatable that you can sell, because at the very least, you can put it onto a war effort and say, good guys win, bad guys lose. Let's support the good guys. But we're also paying for their government.
Yeah.
We are paying the salaries of their government right now. They, if let's say we get to the end of this year, and as the Biden White House has said, the money runs out, if that is true, that means that they are just like, they're just done.
And if they don't have a government, that means Javier, what's his name, the libertarian from Argentina, automatically becomes their head of state.
Afuera!
Afuera! They no longer have a government.
Can I just back that up? Because I have a quote from that hearing to back that up too. Apparently, Ukraine is paying 60% of the war costs, but using its entire tax base to do so. It's our money that is paying for, again, a quote, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian first responders, educators, and healthcare professionals. We don't pay for educators and healthcare professionals in the fucking United States. So, like, why are we paying for all of theirs? Like, I do understand the people in the States being like, why are the Ukrainian getting services that we don't use our own tax money for American citizens? Like, that makes me angry too. And it's not even so much that we're paying for those things, because I would like to have those things paid for with taxes here. But it is amazing to me that we're willing to prop up this government with the clear goal being and stated that they want Ukraine to be a part of the EU and a part of NATO. Like, that's the ultimate goal here, because they also want the, you know, the corporations to have access to it. They don't want them partnered with Russia. I'm curious if the American people were told in those terms that that is what we're funding this government for, why we're paying for this entire government so it can be a part of the EU. How exactly is that our
business? It's a harder sell. And yeah,
so I've got, as you know, Justin, I'm a uniter, not a divider. And I think I have at least some fiscal solution to this that could get some of the fiscal skeptics like myself on board. At present, there are $300 billion of frozen Russian assets sitting in American and European banks, $300 billion worth of money that is primarily that of oligarchs and the Russian central bank in our banks and in European banks. let's just fund whatever we're funding with their money instead of our money. There are going to be some legal issues that come from that. But it seems to me that those are secondary from a perspective of an efficacious and just government in terms of taking our money for all of the purposes that Jen just outlined. I'd rather that come out of that pocket. And we're already having a proxy war with Russia. Like, are we going to hurt their feelings by seizing the assets that are owned by oligarchs in our banks? I don't think we're going to make it worse.
Hold on. Dear listeners, please. Jen is coiled and ready to strike as Heaton has taken the position that the federal government should seize private property of foreign nationals, and Jen's upset about it. Go.
Well, it's not. I mean, I just did an entire Congressional Dish episode on this. I've heard the proposal, and it actually has a lot of support in our government. But if we're doing all of this because we are the rulers of a rules-based international order in an economic system that is based on laws and justice and all that shit.
Democracy.
And democracy.
Freedom.
And then our system takes it upon itself to be like, well, you did a bad thing, and therefore we can seize all of your government's money that you have within our system. How is that not destroying the very international system that we're saying we're preserving by being in Ukraine?
I could see a difference between private actors and governments in terms of how our government approaches them. In the same way that, like, if we were actively at war with a country, being able to seize the money that they have in our country, to me, that would be different than a private citizen taking private citizen money without due course.
But that's exactly you just said that some of the money they're targeting is oligarch, which is code for private citizen money.
Like with sanctions, like, I think there's a difference between sanctioning
but
an entire country
and sugar babies.
Yeah, like
private citizens with yachts.
I see a difference between sanctioning a entire country, which is economic warfare, versus sanctioning key people that we think are part of the war effort, things like that.
But does it bother you at all that we're not actually at war with Russia? Like, we're seizing the assets of a country that we're not actually at war with. Ukraine is at war with them. We are not. And yet we would be taking all of their money. Like, how is that not completely lawless?
You raise some good points. I'm just trying to come up with ways that we could keep money at home.
I mean, that's the thing, though. What are our ideals? What are we fighting for? What are we funding Ukraine for? We keep being told it's to preserve the rules-based international order. If we don't even pretend to follow the rules, how can we pretend that this system is worth anything and certainly worth dying for?
All right, I'll put a pin in that proposal. Okay. I just came up with it this morning. So, like, yeah, I'm not that deeply wedded to it. Can I put a different light on this in terms of just looking at the fiscal side of this? I think that, again, the sum total that Biden's going for, if we add up all the aid to Ukraine, would be around $110 billion. There's about 500, I think about 500.
I think the number that was floated this morning as we record this is that a joint Ukraine-Israel support would be $111 billion.
It's 110, okay. But that also includes some border stuff. Mm-hmm. The Ukraine piece, the military for Ukraine would be about $45 billion. And actually, all of the stuff for, like, their healthcare providers and all of that, it sounds like that's only $2 billion. So it's interesting that the things that I think the American people would be willing to do, like take care of the Ukrainian citizens and the refugees, like, that's a pittance compared to the weapons that they want to buy.
Yeah, I have a hard time getting around the idea that we don't know where we are. The American people do not know where we are in this war. We do not know the aims of the war, aside from what is stated by the Ukrainian government, which is appearing to be more and more of a pipe dream. And that's fine when you are in this act of conflict. You don't want to pre-negotiate with yourself. If you want to start from the position of, we want Crimea, then maybe having something in the middle is better for you. I'm not going to question the Ukrainians in that perspective, but we're years into this now. The appetite for funding it has waned. The Democrats have a problem, and Biden has a real problem, because this is his signature foreign policy win. And when you look at his record moving into an election year, there's not a lot of other gigantic wins. It's the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure bill. They try to have it both ways with the Inflation Reduction Act by joking that it's actually what it was called, but actually signaling to their progressive base, which they have more problems with these days than they did back a few months ago, that it's more of an environmental bill, which it really is. They need Ukraine. But also, they're not telling the story of something that I think the American people would continue to support, because it just seems like something that I compared it on PX3 this week, like the Iraq war, like Afghanistan, just this war that drags on and on and on. And yes, we don't have American service people there now, but it is a financial liability for America when a lot of Americans are feeling very economically insecure, regardless of what the indicators are.
And a long war is what is being promised. It's very open when you listen to what the State Department is telling Congress, that we are in this for the long haul. We need to support Ukraine, because if we don't, then eventually, like you said, like, we're going to have to fight it. Although the reality on the ground is also there's a lot of resistance within Ukraine, apparently, to continuing this fight. Like, they've had so many people die. They're running out of people. The people that are being asked to die are like, for what? To keep trying to take back the field?
I don't think that they're particularly that they're picking people out to say you will die on the front lines. But
like when you're,
they've had a desertion problem. They've had a recruiting problem.
They have. And they're not being allowed to vote to change their current government. The election was supposed to already have happened. It has been canceled. So they have Zelensky. So even the idea of like, well, we're fighting for democracy over there. Well, the Ukrainians should get the opportunity to change their leadership if it's not working out for them in a democracy.
Which should also be a slam dunk. Like your popularity is never higher than when you're at war, particularly if you're being invaded. I would think that I'm not sure why they're not doing it. Like, it would, if I were Zelensky, you would probably be winning by like 80% or something like that.
Unless you're unpopular.
Unless this is less popular inside of Ukraine than it is outside of
Ukraine. Unless your own generals, which this is happening, are saying to the press, we're in a stalemate and we think that Zelensky is living in a fantasy land. Like, that might be a sentiment in Ukraine. We can't measure it, though, because they've canceled the elections in their democracy. So it's really hard to look at this situation and be like, I'm in for funding this for the long haul. At the same time, let's also acknowledge that if we do pull out, they will fail. They will fail. Their government fails. They can't fight without our weapons. So it's like, I think one more tranche is absolutely needed. But I do think the American people, and I'm speaking for myself here, I need to hear endgame. I need to hear plans. Right. I need to hear negotiations.
This is the beginning of an endgame.
There's
no maybe, all right, a draft gets leaked to the Atlantic of what a possible peace plan would be. Everyone denies it. The White House denies it. Zelensky denies it. But at least you're floating out the idea that at some point there might be some kind of push to end this.
So what I'm hearing in Congress is the State Department saying, we need to figure out a way to get these companies in, to get the energy sector functioning, to get the fossil fuels flowing, to get the grain flowing while the war continues. They're not talking about after, they're talking at the same time.
So there is one big problem with trying to come up with any type of when do we cut our losses strategy. Now, we're not quite talking about that. We're looking at what a ceasefire or what a peace would look like. My general inclination, if I were running some kind of program, would be it should have X result. And if it falls short of that, we'll scrap it, something to that effect. Unfortunately, that's very difficult to do with foreign policy, because if we said Ukraine has to take X amount of territory back or push them out by X time or whatever, otherwise we're going to withdraw, that would telegraph to Russia, all it has to do is stick around one day past that.
Yeah.
And so like same thing kind of happened with the Taliban. So in addition to, God damn it, Heaton's America First policy of let's worry about foreign funding when we've got less homeless people than the state of Wyoming as citizens. I'm going to do provision two. Heaton's foreign policy regarding Ukraine. Ukraine is a sovereign nation. They get to make their own decisions, and we shouldn't play otherwise. They're in charge of their own affairs. That said, our funding is our decision and our affairs. And what I would love to have happen is for Joe Biden or Anthony Blinken to call up Putin and say, what would you need from us to quit killing people? I just want, not saying we're committing to anything, I would like to know what that option is. Because if the deal was Ukraine joins the European Union, but it doesn't join NATO, that's all we want. If that's what it were, I would take that deal in a heartbeat. I think that that would be great for them. If that would be, I doubt at that point that's what it is. I think at this point it's completely fucked, because four of the oblasts are now a part of Russian Federation, according to Russia. Like, I think it's all messed up. That said, I would like to know what the options on the table are, because there might be a way to quit killing people and get something for everybody at this point.
Well, we will have to wait and see. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong is where you need to go if you want to get a bonus episode of this show. Two topics on the main show, one topic on the Patreon, and it's always a delight. And this one is going to be no different. Expelled Congressman George Santos, now officially out of Congress, is on Cameo. And Senator John Fetterman used his services to poke at a fellow Democrat. We will talk about all things influencer, the exit of Santos, and John Fetterman's campaign to needle Bob Menendez, something that I'm just assuming Jen was thrilled by.
I was.
Get all that. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong. Thank you guys so much for supporting us. Bigger, fun things coming your way soon. Let's play the hits here. It's the holiday season. People want some feel good. Let's go. Let's go to Prince Harry, who has initiated a legal challenge against the UK Interior Ministry concerning his security arrangements in the UK. This follows a February 2020 decision by a Royal Security Committee to downgrade his personal protective security after he stepped back from frontline royal duties and moved to North America. Represented by Shahid Fatima, Harry argues that the decision affects his rights to quote-unquote security and safety, and that his high profile as a member of the royal family should have been the key consideration in this decision. James Eady, representing the Home Office, countered Harry's security needs were handled lawfully and tailored to his status as a non-working royal living mostly abroad. He mentioned that considerations about the impact on his decisions, including the tragic death of Harry's mother, Princess Diana, were taken into account. Previously, Harry requested for a legal review of the government's refusal to let him pay for UK police protection was denied. The Home Office in London's Metropolitan Police argued that it's not appropriate for individuals to pay for such security as it may or may not align with the public interest and could put officers at risk. This case is being heard in private due to the sensitive nature of the security details involved, and the British don't care about free speech. I added that editorially. The hearing is set to conclude on Thursday with a decision to be announced later. Heaton, should the wayward put upon prince get his security?
Yeah, I think probably so. I'm sorry, Justin. I know you were hoping for blood sport on this one. Yeah, I think probably so. So this is what I'm thinking. Like, I'm not a huge Harry and Meghan fan. I usually refer to him as the hostage.
What?
When we're having discussions, I call him the hostage is my position on him. Here's my thought. He's the son of their head of state.
Yeah.
That means that he is a high profile target for people that would want to kill him. The terrorists, whoever it is, crazy people, something like that, right? It's a sizable thing.
You could just say Irish.
The Irish would want to murder him. Yes, there's a lot of Irish people that would love to kill Harry. But it's a legitimate high profile target. It would be a thing. My preference would be that now that Harry is a non-working royal, that he pay for his own security, given the amount of financial resources that he and his wife have. He tried to do that. He's got five court cases before the high court right now. Four of them are going after tabloids, which in my view are run by scumbags for the benefit of semi-literates. So good luck there. And the fifth one is the security detail. But there was a preceding case with the high court, I think in October, where he wanted to hire off-duty police officers in the London police force to be his guards when he was in the UK. And that was turned down by the court on the understanding that there is a limited amount of police officers and they are public officials, and private people should not be able to hire public officials because they're a public utility, or they're working for a public utility. Fair enough. But there does not appear to be a recourse for him to hire private security. Again, there are ways you probably could do this in the United Kingdom. There are extremely stringent rules, but there are people that are armed. So if you're transporting a...
That's interesting. I was wondering why he was so specific about wanting to hire off-duty cops, but that might be a way that you could just get protection with firearms faster.
Yeah,
than a bunch of ex-MI6 people.
To clarify, I don't know that he said off duty, but that is my presumption that it was off duty. That was originally what they wanted to do. They were turned down because that means there's a limited amount of cops. You can't just cops should not be the playthings of the rich was basically the takeaway on that. Okay, if there were a different recourse to hire private security, which would be a lot easier to do in the United States, I would say go for that. You can have armed guards for like money trucks for banks. And I think there's some other small caveat where if you do a bunch of training and things like that, there might be ways to do it, but that doesn't seem to be
third lead on suits.
Third lead on suits. Yes.
Is that one of the carve outs?
Yes. Yeah.
When you're married to the third lead on suits, it's very popular on Netflix.
Anyway, that option was denied to them. So at that point, yeah, I'm not really surprised that not being able to pay for his own private security. And the better option after that would be, how about the crown pays for it? Because the crown has a bunch of money that it didn't earn and it didn't do anything for. It just inherited it from stealing from peasants from the last 1,000 years. It has a lot of money. So how about we take some of that peasant money and they do it? Well, they don't want to do that. Okay. At that
They're
point,
fighting.
If the...
They're fighting with Harry.
I know. Adults should be put in charge of the crown, if not most of the estate liquidated and put in a sovereign wealth fund or something.
They should do a Spotify podcast about it.
They should, again, because they've got the money.
Or maybe a Netflix series.
See, this is the thing. They've got the money to do it, but they can't hire the private security. If they've got the money, they're offering to pay for private security, and they can't get private security because they're turned down by the British government. At that point, yeah, if the only option
resort—
Why can't
they get private security that's like Blackwater? Like, why does it have to be through the British government if they're in— Santa Barbara.
Can't dial 1-900 whack a hut.
Or go next door to Oprah and be like, no. Like, where do you get your stuff?
This court case where they're suing RAVEC, the relevant royal institution that determines allocation of security forces for the royal family, this is only pertinent to when Harry is visiting the United Kingdom. This does not have to do with his time in Canada or California. That is their business. They can hire Blackwater. I'm sure they do have private security details in the United States. It's just when they decide to go to London to bet on horses or go cockfighting or whatever the British ex-royals do when they visit London. We're just talking about these situations. Now, to fill this in, on the other side, the royalist side of this or RAVEC or whatever, what they're basically saying is, look, Harry's very entitled. There are security details in place, but we do it situation by situation for him. And he's demanding to have a kind of permanent cohort of security guards, whereas we're going to allocate them on a case-by-case basis. But as you pointed out, Justin, these are sealed. So I can't see, like, I have no means by which to determine how entitled. Like, is he demanding a limo and, like, a fleet of armed people? Or, like, I don't know. We're not able to see those things.
We don't know.
Horse and carriage.
Yeah.
Jen?
I mean, I think he absolutely deserves not only private security when in London. I think that the crown should be paying for his security wherever he is, all over the world, because he didn't choose to be a part of this insane system. And it's not like he's some royal that's down the rung. Like, he's the son of the king. So like you said, like, you call him the hostage because of Meghan.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of people that think that it would be a good idea to take this man hostage, because even though, you know, his father and his brother act like they don't give a shit, I'm pretty sure that they would try and save his life.
Even if they don't like him, it'd be a big fucking deal if he got captured. Yes.
It really would, yeah. And
like, it would be amazing if the king came out and went, well, this is my king. Well, he's not a working member of the royal family no more, so it don't matter that he's been captured. Like, they're not going to do that.
Even the idea, like, working member of the royal family, can you just shut up? Like, you're going and shaking hands and... like, just stop.
You're being a mascot.
Well, so where I do think that was relevant.
Dedicating your life to being a mascot, like, I don't see why he has to do that, because he's born into this family. He chose a different way. But his life has been determined based on this structure that he had nothing to do with creating, that he really, he had no choice in any of it. Like, his mother had a choice to go into it. Meghan had a choice to go into it. Harry and Will did not. And so Will is the future king. Harry's the spare. I think he deserves protection 100%, and it shouldn't be on his own dime. I think his life has been kind of unfair. I've always been sympathetic to him, and his life is in actual danger pretty much every day. So, yeah, I think he deserves security.
Out in Calabasas?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why these millionaires that live out there have these compounds. Like, you can't just go up to their front door. There's private security for every single one of them. The difference is that Oprah chose to be famous. She chose to have a TV show. You know, those type of people, they chased fame. Harry was born into it. His birth was a big deal. Like, he was photographed as an infant 2 days out of the vag. So, like,
The royal vag, thank you. The royal vagina.
Sorry,
that was noble labia. Show some respect.
Yeah, this guy didn't choose it. So there is a difference. So yeah, even in Santa
Barbara.
Finally,
somebody standing up for Nepo babies.
So wait, so Jenna.
Yeah, he's not just some rich guy. This is an institution that is somehow governmentally condoned. So it's not just that he's rich. This is a different thing. And I think the fact that he didn't have an option, I think that should matter.
Jen and I are agreeing way too hard this episode. So can I throw some grist?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Well, I also have some shots to take at the latest season of The Crown. So
okay.
Me too. Yeah, great. Let's go.
So I like to secondary issue. I do think the working royal is relevant when Meghan Markle and Harry want to have an allowance from The Crown. And they made a big deal. They made a big statement that said, we're stepping back from our duties. We're keeping the title, but we're stepping back. We're keeping the title. We're stepping back from our duties. We're still Duke and Duchess of our royal family duties of cutting ribbons at Piggly Wigglies or whatever they have over there. And then The Crown went, well, okay, well, if you're not working, we're not giving you money then. And then they freaked out. They were like, well, you have to give us money. We're royals. And they went, well, you have to cut ribbons, assholes. So like that bit I think is relevant. If they're not going to do whatever the hell the job is, of you know, going to vineyards and talking to people that own horses and exotic game and stuff, then they don't need to get allowance for it. But in terms of the security detail, yeah, like The Crown should be paying for it. I don't think the taxpayers should be paying for it. I think The Crown should.
I think we also agree that the taxpayers shouldn't be paying for The Crown.
Yeah, like so, okay, this is one of the things. All right,
I thought you were a monarchist.
Two things. I think this is what I want. I want to separate power from reverence. I think that's very important. So like Ireland has done this. Ireland, the president has very little power.
Sure.
He is
and things are going great there right now.
He's an adorable figurehead. And the prime, I don't know what the word is, but whatever their prime minister equivalent is the real seat of power. In the United Kingdom, I think that they have accomplished this accidentally, but brilliantly nonetheless, over the last 300 years, where reverence is vested in the ceremonial monarch, who basically has a big gilded bully pulpit, but does not have actual levers of power at his or her disposal. The power rests in Parliament that everybody hates and makes fun of. I think that's the best system in the world, where you're giving all of this, you know, I disagree with the so-and-so, but I respect blah, blah, blah. You're giving that to somebody that doesn't have the power to tax you or send people off to die. That's great. So for that reason, I'm in favor of having a ceremonial monarch. But a ceremonial monarch's different than a hereditary dictator, like in Saudi Arabia, like a real monarch. I don't want a real monarch. I want a cute, stylized, ornamental head of state that can't fuck around with government. And I want them on ceremonial plates that people buy and think about and talk about. That way, when they're actually looking at government, they're willing to kick the fuck out of it and actually go to town with it and have some teeth.
But so, what's the point of this ceremonial plate face? Like, why do you need these people?
I think humans are, our species wants to have like a tribal chieftain or a totem or something. And it seems to be built into us. And in our country, we have very dangerously said, well, we'll have the head of government also be the head of state. So the person that can tax you, kick your door down, have the FBI come in, send you off to war, that guy is also the father of the nation, the seer of seers, the chaplain of our country, who embodies all of our values and the spiritual fortitude of the people of the United States. That's a bad idea. So I like the idea of there being a ceremonial monarchy. The bit that I've got a problem with in terms of the British system, the ceremonial monarchy bit, is the money. If they're adding, like, for the things that they're doing, the cutting ribbons and all of that, they should have a salary from taxpayers of like 200,000 quid a year or something like that, like make it on par with the prime minister or whatever, because they're doing functions of state. That's work. They should be paid for it. I got no problem with that at all. The problem I have is the massive, massive, massive crown estate that was never anything that the crown provided value for. It was just money taken from the commons, taken from poor people and peasants, and just held on to. Like there's a difference between, if I tell you somebody's 200 pounds, there's a difference between being fat or being muscular in that 200 pounds, right? Like where your wealth comes from, for me, the validity of it is dependent on the value you provided. Exploitative wealth, extractive wealth is functionally different than wealth which adds value. So the assets that the royal family has are not things that they made. They're things that they took. And I would nationalize most of it, put it in a sovereign wealth fund. Let them keep Windsor. Let them keep Balmoral. They can keep their house and have a salary. And then the rest of the time, when we're talking about you know, Harry getting abducted by the Irish or the Laplanders or whoever's mad at him this month, have the security detail come out of the crown.
Let's talk about the crown. So have you seen any of this show, Heaton?
I watched the first season and I liked it, but I just kind of fizzled out.
It's a guilty pleasure. I like it. I think it illustrates the fact that the Queen is probably the greatest nonfiction character that you could choose for a show like that, because she's lived through so much and you can put her at the center of world events. And by and large, the casting on that show has been amazing.
Yeah.
They've cast the Queen perfect three times to move her through various points in her life. They've largely cast all the kids great, her husband great, until this season.
Yeah.
When they cast Dominic West, McNulty from The Wire, if you are familiar with that show, as Prince Charles. Dominic West has more charisma in his left eye than Prince Charles has ever exhibited in his entire life. There are entire scenes in The Wire where self-destructive alcoholic McNulty just fucks women like James Bond because he gives them a sideways glance. That's the and you buy it because you're like, Dominic West is an absolute powerhouse.
He's pretty hot.
And then they cast him as Prince Charles, who is the most sniveling. And they write him as a sniveling, pathetic character who is backstabbing his mom so he can gild the skids for him to become king, which, spoiler alert, I guess he eventually does. I don't know how they're going to cover that on the show. But what a miss. What a whiff to cast somebody that charismatic as Prince Charles.
Who would you have cast as Prince Charles?
A coat rack. Like, you could, like somebody that you immediately look at and you're like, boy, do I hate you. I think that you are a spoiled brat who, like, the first two episodes are basically all based on the idea that he is trying to whip up public sentiment and court the prime minister to make a public push that the Queen should abdicate and he should assume the throne. That is the I assume the through line for this season is him trying to do that in the 90s as he soars to popularity with Diana. But that their marriage is falling apart, and it's partly because he's so power hungry. That's a loathsome character, especially as we've followed the Queen for now six seasons, perfect or imperfect. You root for her because she was thrust into the limelight, blah, 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 blah. This has been a horrifying, horrifying miscasting. The worst decision that Netflix has made since giving Prince Harry a bunch of money for literally no reason. Jen?
Well, I also, this season, so one of the things I liked about the first few seasons, and you saw the first season.
Yeah.
They focused on individual events, and some of them were things I had no idea ever happened. And then at the end, they tell you what happened and you can go on Wikipedia and like, oh, this was a real thing.
Yeah.
Like, I learned something from it. In this latest season, they took some creative license with Diana and Dodi. And I kind of followed the Diana story pretty closely. And there's a lot of stuff that they said in The Crown that I just don't think are facts that are now going to go down in a lot of people's memories as facts, like where they were in their relationship.
I've not gotten that far of
and that's, I don't want to like spoiler alert it, but like Joe and I were sitting there like, did this even happen?
No, spoil it.
And
spoil
if it,
it
did, they just, okay, spoiler. I am going to spoil it for you. They basically say that Dodi was proposing to Diana in the Ritz-Carlton before they got in the car and died. Like that he had an engagement ring and it was because of his father. They have this very detailed, in-depth conversation about Dodi's relationship with his dad. I don't know where the fuck they're getting this from. Because if that was the case, I would feel like everyone would know this. So, and when asked about it, because I've been watching a lot of BBC, when asked about it, they're like, well, you know, like we make some inferences because we can't be in those conversations. So yeah, we had to make some inferences on what we think happened. But that was just, I think they're just making shit up.
That was a bridge too far.
A little bit, yeah. And just the way they portrayed Dodi and his father, like it felt really icky to me what they did there.
They definitely pushed in the previous season that she was cheating on Charles with that red-haired military guy.
Oh, the
what,
one.
What circumstantial evidence to that effect exists?
Was it the tennis instructor?
They do not say specifically that. Oh, they don't tie it to Harry specifically, but they did make sure to point out that this guy has flaming red hair.
I thought that the Harry lookalike was her tennis instructor. Because if you look at the pictures, man.
You know what? So 2-3 years ago, my family did a 23andMe test because we were really hoping for not white. We were really hoping some bit like maybe something, right?
You were hoping to at least go over Warren?
Yeah. Well, it turns out we're exactly, mom's side of the family is exactly Warren level Native American. But like not a whole lot of other stuff. Storm of mayonnaise. I think it'd be really funny if the royal family did a 23andMe test. They're like, it's weird. Harry has a very different genetic profile than William. How's that? They've got the same mom and dad. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, one's hot and the other is Will.
How did that happen? If Harry wants to earn his money from Spotify and Netflix,
do a 23andMe test.
That's the special.
Yeah.
The live special where you reveal his 23andMe.
Yeah.
Have Maury Povich come back from whatever cave he's in and be like, here's your real father.
That like Prince Charles, you are not the father. And then Harry starts dancing.
God, you know what would have been the fucking smartest?
He starts swinging a tennis
racket. Fucking smartest thing in the world that he could have done was get some of his grandmother's hair before he went to America just to have her DNA on file. Because like imagine if Charles was not actually Philip's kid or something like that. Like if you were Harry and you had that is some hostage level shit right there where you're like, actually, I would like the Duchy of Lancaster or whatever.
Yeah.
23andMe test. That'd be fun.
Stories like that are what got Epstein killed.
Season 7 on The Crown.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Scary ghost stories of Christmases long, long ago. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. The Yankee Doodle Panther origin story writes, so you're telling me that Heaton comes from a family of judges and outlaw rodeo clowns? Suddenly, his career path of analyzing jurisprudence while advertising a horseback restaurant makes a lot more sense.
Yep. Now you know the prequel.
Plain Diplomacy writes, I traveled to work to Washington, D.C. the week after Thanksgiving, flying out late Tuesday morning along with my state's entire Democratic House delegation. I returned Thursday afternoon, this time with the delegation of Democratic senators from my state, plus a few others connecting in Denver. I had the opportunity to talk with legislators on both legs, sitting between my senator and his chief of staff on the return flight. We made a bit of small talk, and when we landed, I thanked the senator for what he does and he apologized for the mess in D.C. Including prior interactions with legislators, I am convinced that my state's congressional delegation includes some of the only sane voices in Washington, except for one House Republican that you've previously discussed.
Out of curiosity, he mentions Denver. Was the state in question Colorado, or do we not have that in context?
I presume that the one House Republican that we have discussed is Lauren Boebert. So, yes, I believe he is referring to Colorado.
Two things to this listener. One, I actually think that Colorado Democrats are great. I think Jared Polis is a fantastic governor. I really like Hickenlooper and Michael Bennett. I think that they are like they are good, sane market Democrats that I would prefer be the standard bearers of the party. So I think you're right. The delegation from Colorado is a good one. That being said, I would advise everybody, myself included, to remember that there's a kind of Jedi mind trick that happens with politicians whenever you talk to them, where when I worked in the House, I would get in the elevator and there's always constituents coming to visit. And I would always ask the same questions. Where are you visiting from? We're visiting from Frog Belch, Wyoming. Great. Where are you visiting from? We're visiting from Longstain, Maryland. Awesome. Do you like your representative? And everybody had the exact same reaction, which was, oh yeah, he's a great guy. Like Congress is a bunch of crooks, but our dude, he's the last guy with his head screwed on straight. So everybody in America shares the same position that you have, that their congressman, not everybody, a significant amount of people in America go, I like my congressman. I hate Congress. You see this in the polls for the last 30 years that people like their individual member of Congress. They hate Congress as an institution. So just keep that in mind that we all might have that kind of like politician reaching into the back of your skull and massaging your brain until they like you thing. We're always at risk of that.
Which dovetails to the fact that congressmen get reelected at a proportionally high rate.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, like, let's bring up the like Jen, should we play our song on ranked choice voting and open primaries? God. Like the system is rigged to facilitate incumbency. So yes, like, but it yes. And there are some other factors as well.
Well, I mean, I think you It's easier to like these people when you look at them as individuals. Even as someone, like, I never worked in Congress like you did, but I've watched them for a long time. There are plenty of people whose voting records I absolutely adore that I would love to go to dinner with, yeah, that I think are perfectly nice people. There was a Republican, she's not in Congress anymore, but she's my best example of this, Martha Roby. She was from Alabama. She was a sweet little lady. I could see her making cookies for everyone in the Congress. Like, she just seemed really sweet. I hated her voting record. And I think at the end of the day, what they vote for affects your life more than if they're nice to you on a plane.
I agree. That's why, like, when I meet politicians, I go in with a presumption that I am almost certainly going to like them when I leave. I am a Labrador retriever in cowboy boots. I like everybody. I really like politics. So I just go in, I'm going to like them. And I can go out and have the ability to go, I like him, but I wouldn't vote against him, or I wouldn't vote for him. Like, yeah, like, you know, a like perfectly nice person that I think should be in the private sector instead of the public sector.
Give the devil his due, writes, in your last episode, you were all complaining that Trump was being denied due process by states that are trying to keep his name off the ballot next November. None of these states are unilaterally dropping his name from their ballots. They are simply asking the courts to rule on whether he's eligible to run, given this verbiage in the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Asking a court to rule on a law is due process. That's what due process looks like.
Sir, you are in cohate. this is an incohate email.
What does incohate mean?
Nonsensical, doesn't come together.
Okay.
when the Trump campaign attempted to thwart democracy in the last election, it did so by going to the courts and saying that the integrity of the election had been challenged. Therefore, we are asking you through established legal precedent and law to suspend the counting of ballots in select locations. So they were attempting to go through the court system to technically use the law to technically change the election. I don't see a significant difference between this. The attempt right now is to stop voters from being able to exercise their will in order to participate in democracy and have the courts restrict that. This to me is the same outcome. It's just that you like the out, or excuse me, it's the same method. You just like the outcome this time. Well, I'm concerned about the procedure and I'm concerned about the method.
Jen?
Ditto.
Yes, there was a Trump roast, writes. It was part of the annual celebrity roast series on Comedy Central. Seth MacFarlane was the host.
I might have to watch this. Although, I love Seth MacFarlane.
Apparently, there are only clips available on YouTube. It is not available to purchase anywhere.
Ooh, this makes me think conspiracy that, like, Seth MacFarlane had some cool monologue where he's like, but seriously, we all love Donald Trump. He's a great guy. And they got it pulled.
There are places for which you can see it. Mm. I would assume that, I mean, if it follows the pattern of all roasts, there usually is a thing at the end where they say, hey, seriously, Donald.
Yeah.
You know, you're a real nice guy.
And also keep mind up until 2016, he was this kind of funny blowhard that everybody remembered from Home Alone 2 and The Apprentice. So, like, I wouldn't even call anybody out for those statements.
I mean, the most telling thing is when Trump's voicemail got hacked and they published all the things that were on his voicemail, they were almost all media people that were thanking him for a favor that he did for them. He was extraordinarily well-liked with media folks. Like, that is, you know, either for charitable donations or thank you for introducing me to X, Y, or Z. That was something for which, you know, he was a glad hander in New York City. So it's kind of stuff that happens.
Bergmentum writes, as an Iowan, I'm going to caucus for Doug Burgum now. Even if it's just me and my elementary school gym, I'm going to try to get as many people behind me as possible. So Doug Bergman was who Heaton said was going to win the caucus.
I genuinely feel really bad about this because I watched the first Republican presidential debate and he was the one where I'm like, maybe. Like he struck me as like, oh, he seems like kind of a moderate business guy who's not an asshole. Like, I don't automatically hate this man as much as I hate several of the others. And even I didn't bother to learn his name. I feel responsible. I feel I should have, because if I couldn't do it, who else could be expected to do it? I should have stepped up and I apologize.
You know, he did that debate with a torn ACL.
Man.
And he said that he stood the entire time without painkillers, which I don't even think is possible to then talk. Well, because if he's on painkillers,
you didn't want to have a Rick Perry back pain medication moment, like back in 2012.
So he
forget which departments he was going to destroy, and then ask Ron Paul.
Yeah, and then he whoops.
I don't remember. Ron will tell you.
There, yeah. There's three departments that are gone. Education,
commerce. I don't remember them. Ron will tell you.
Whoops.
But on the way here, I heard that there were four people that are going to be in this debate. I think tomorrow, and he's not one of them.
Oh no, he dropped out this week.
Yeah, he dropped out this week.
He actually dropped out this week.
He actually called me out by name. I felt really bad about it. I was like, you know what? He was right. He was right. I don't even try and shed that.
I'm still baffled by all this.
What do you mean?
These people that are dropping out.
Yeah.
No one's voted. Like, how is this our system? All these people are dropping out based on polls. No one's voted. If the idea is that Iowa has to be first because people like Doug Birnbaum, whatever his name is.
Birnbaum!
If this guy can get popular enough by going door to door in Iowa, like, they're all dropping out. I just don't understand a democracy in which the race is over before any of us get to vote. This system makes no sense to me, and I hate it.
They're not dropping out because of polls. They're dropping out because they don't have enough money to continue to run a campaign that can get their message out to people.
That's even worse.
Okay. Again, this gets into this magic beans version of democracy that you seem to think is possible, where money is not exchanged for labor, so professionals
can
help you spread your word.
My magic beans theory of democracy, where people stay on the ballot and wait for people to vote before we find out who was ahead in the voting. Like, it doesn't cost that much to put your name on the ballot. I understand the political realities that you're saying that, like, to get your message out. But, like, let the people vote on you. Like, the fact that this election is being whittled down like this before any of us get to vote, just thinking just of that we had a whole bunch of candidates and now it's going to be whittled down to like two, maybe three by the time any of us get to have an actual say in it, I think is fucking bizarre. And whatever the realities are, I think it's still fucking bizarre. And I don't know why we accept this. Like, it's weird.
A couple of like situations where it would make sense. So like Tim Scott recently dropped out. We mentioned this last week, but I loved his statement that he went, the American people have clearly said, Tim, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet, Tim.
Not yet.
That America with one voice said, you will be our president, just not right now. In Tim Scott's case, he's a sitting senator. So if Tim Scott is looking at the polls and he's like, I'm not even cracking 2%. I do not think I'm going to win this. I'm no longer in this. I can sit on the ballot and half-ass a campaign and not actually give my all to the people who are supporting me, not give my all to the staff working for me, or alternately not really be in it, but take time away from my job representing the people of my state. I think both of those are very realistic reasons. If you just think you are not cracking 2% to go, I've got an obligation to my constituency and I've got an obligation to actually do this to the best of my abilities. And I don't think I'm going to win it. And I don't want to do it anymore.
It's just like, fine. Like, I'm not judging any of them for dropping out for their own reasons. I'm just looking at it like a systemic thing. I think we know our democracy is broken, but every time I look at,
but it's like, on the ballot.
Why do the American people have to pay attention if we had 11 candidates and by the time we actually vote, we're already down to two anyway. So what's the point of all of this if it's not a circle jerk for pundits and donors? And like, I don't feel like,
hey,
part
yo,
of this process.
Some of us are trying to make a living here.
I know. And you're making a good one. And like, great for you. I know you love the political game, but I'm looking at it as like, where's my role in this? Because this candidate, by the time we vote, it seems like it's over.
Well, you wouldn't have had a vote anyway because you're not a member of the Republican Party.
I mean, I might register as a member of the Republican Party. And that's the other thing, too.
I would for you to register as a member of the Republican Party.
Jim. I want to have a fucking vote. Yeah. So I might do it because that's my right, apparently. And I'm in Texas. And it's the only party that matters.
So something that we're all in agreement on, especially Justin, is open primaries and top five ranked choice voting.
Jesus.
Now, if we have top five ranked choice voting, I think this makes a lot more sense. Absent top five ranked choice voting right now. If you are a Doug Bergman character, who's one of the, what is it again? Bergman?
Birdbomb.
Birdbomb.
No, just keep going.
You're Doug Bergman. my favorite Republican, Doug Bergman.
Doug Birdman, attorney at law.
Doug Bergman. But like, let's say that you're one of those characters. You're looking at all of the data. You're meeting people and you're like, this isn't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And the longer, like say you're a Republican and you don't want Trump to win, you stay in, you know that you're guaranteeing he's going to do that. I mean, that happened.
I understand the political calculus. I just think it's nuts that in a primary that a lot of people are not waiting for us to vote before. Like, are we going to get to the point where we go to vote and it's only Trump and Biden on the ballot? Are we just like done with having primaries in this country? Is that where we're at? We have all this wasted time and hours.
I don't know where you think this is the most effect that the populace has had on a primary system ever.
We haven't voted.
I'm aware. And this is the most populist our primary system has ever been.
How? We haven't voted.
In our history.
We're not getting to participate in this primary.
I'm not saying that if you were defining, I'm just saying compared to the past, we had less control. We had less of a say into things before, especially before small dollar donations, than we do now. This is the most effect that you can have on a primary, either in or out of a state. Now, for some people, the calculus that they make is, I'm not going to win. I don't see the crowds. I know what my traffic is on my website. I know what the indicators are to a successful campaign, and I have none of them. And so they decide to fold their tent, and usually they endorse somebody. The weird thing about this scenario is nobody's endorsed anybody, which is odd. But they usually have, they have reasons for doing what they are doing. And I think that they're legitimate. I don't quite understand your position that we all need to have a say on all primaries before we get to a general election.
My position is simply, if we're having a primary, we should get to vote in it. Like, if we're going
Who's
to have
we?
The voters right now, there's a
Nationally.
Whole whittling down of candidates that is happening without voters involved. And it bothers me. I think that we should have a voting process in the whittling down of candidates. And we're not having that. It sounds like we have four left and the primaries don't even begin for another, what, month, 2 months? Like, I just think it's a very weird system.
A month. I know that because I still need to book our Iowa stuff.
Ugh, Iowa. But like, why are we going? Why are we going if there's
it's
no
awesome.
One left? There's no one left. Why are we doing this?
I'm struggling to follow a little bit. Can you give me a counterfactual of like what would a better system look like?
We already know. Ranked choice voting makes more sense. Like, there's so many things that make more sense.
But that's voting day. You're upset that people are not staying in the race.
Because the system, as you guys, like, there's these political calculations that are being made based on polls and donors and web clicks and all these things, all these factors that don't include votes. All these factors that don't include votes. So by the time us voters are actually checked in and ready to vote, all these options that we had, like, maybe people like Doug Batman. Like, I don't know. Maybe he was a good candidate, but because he didn't get to stick around, by the time people actually go to vote, he's not an option anymore. Mike Pence isn't an option anymore.
They've made these calculations
so early.
So you
don't get a choice. So why pay attention?
So you made a very good point earlier that that you have to pay some amount of money to file in a state, but it's not like you have to keep doing it, right? You file
once. One time.
So
get on the ballot.
So noting this, that they're already on the ballot. Why do you think people are dropping out? There is no mechanism forcing them to right now, other than their own internal calculus.
Each individual person, as you've said, like, they all have their reasons. They have their poll numbers. They have their current jobs. They have their wives. But I don't care what their individual reasons are. I'm looking at from a systemic point of view as a voter. I'm not someone who's been watching any of these debates. Why should we? Why should we participate in any of this system if by the time we actually get to participate, it's pretty much over?
Mandatory conscripted campaigning.
It just sounds like this is a big game so that, you know, donors and it sounds like donors are picking our candidates. It sounds like pundits are making, and I'm sorry, Justin, but like, it sounds like the DC class gets a whole year of content out of a race that's not real if it's not being determined by votes and it's being determined by other things. I just wish that votes were a bigger part of this primary system. And it bothers me that it seems to be an afterthought with the way this whole structure is going. Whatever the calculations are, votes are not determining it.
Afterthought, I think, is very, very strong. I don't believe that this particular season will be competitive through Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Super Tuesday, but oftentimes, usually, it is. And so votes do determine a lot. We are in the end game of a phase of the campaign that is a lot about polling and donors and staffing and all the stuff that goes along with running a campaign.
So we are at the high point of that. If you are frustrated with that, I can understand it, because it has only gotten longer and longer and longer that we consider a campaign season, quote unquote, beginning. But with that being said, I don't quite know what the benefit for candidates who don't believe that they have a shot are to stay in a race that they don't believe that they can win.
And those calculus on each individual basis might make perfect sense in a system that I think is fundamentally broken. That's my problem with this whole system. It just feels very broken to me. And I'm frustrated as a voter that by the time I get to vote, my choices, it looks like it's going to be Trump or Biden before the primaries even happen. And I'm so frustrated with it. So well, I'm watching these other candidates.
It won't be that. Okay. Like, it's, I mean, like when we go to Iowa, we're going to probably see Ron DeSantis live. We're going to see Nikki Haley live. We're going to see Vivek Ramaswamy live. And we'll probably see Trump live. There will be at least four strong candidates who have put a lot of time and a lot of effort. Ron DeSantis completed what is known as the full Grassley in Iowa this week, which is visiting all 99 counties of Iowa. So he has spent a lot of time.
Wore down those heels.
There.
Had to get brand new heels.
Exactly. This time he's going to put goldfish in.
Jen, I share your rancor and umbrage when looking at the American electoral system. This is something that I think is like foundational and fundamental to a vast majority of the problems that we see in governance. I'm very much a structuralist. I think it boils down to structure. I think we've got a bad incentive structure, and we've got really awful gatekeeping mechanisms that compel the system to gravitate towards extremist characters that represent a party rather than the constituency. All of those things I fundamentally believe. I'm bothered by that. I'm not really bothered by if I were going to run for governor or something like that, and the polling was abysmal and people didn't seem that interested and I wasn't raising any money and just all indicators were people just don't want me for governor, I would drop out in part just because like maybe if I run for governor in the future, I don't want to have like a horrible losing record on me. So I can think of enough situations in this part of the electoral system. This is not something that bothers me, that someone that just doesn't catch fire would choose to drop out before the election.
Yeah, I'm not saying like, I don't know how I'm not explaining this well. It's not the individual decisions. They all make sense for their own reasons. It's just the system. Like, we've been talking about these primaries now for a year. We've wasted so much breath and time talking about candidates that we will never get a chance to vote for or against. It's going on for so long. And like, I just, by the time the votes happen, yeah, I'm just, I hate this system. These primaries don't feel real to me. I don't understand why a voter.
Why do they feel real?
Because it's already like half over. All these
candidates.
It
hasn't begun.
Exactly. And we've been talking about this shit for a year. We've been having debates. Like, I don't understand why any American voter should be paying attention to any of these people, knowing that half of them won't be there when it's time to vote.
This is a fight within the Republican Party. This is a fight of ideas and where the party is going to go and who's going to lead it. This happens once every 4 years, and sometimes it's both parties. Sometimes it's one party, depending on who the president is. This is an internal argument with the Republicans.
Yeah, within the parties.
Yeah.
That's another problem. We have these two parties that have their own systems. Like, I'm just frustrated with the whole thing. I feel like we have this opportunity where our government is going unquestionably bad. Like, there are so many things that are going wrong, especially in Congress. I hate this Congress so much. I think Joe Biden is an unmitigated disaster on foreign policy. I don't trust him at all. I trust Trump even less. And I'm looking at this opportunity that we have to change things next year. And the system that we have is making that damn near impossible to do. And I'm so frustrated by it. And like, every time I hear, well, another candidate's gone, so there's another less option for you when voting time comes. I'm just like, what the fuck is the point?
Can I backtrack a little bit on something that I haven't really thought about before? The idea of scrutinizing primaries and talking about the candidates and the creep of how long the election season lasts, I think is going to be a very linked function to how prominent politics is in our lives. So if politics is becoming bigger and bigger in the American experience in terms of the amount of influence it has over our lives, the economy, everything else, culturally, all those things, then a natural function of that is just going to be people are going to talk about politics a lot more. Campaign season is going to last longer. Like the bigger the political size of the country, the bigger the state, the more scrutiny and dialogue and analysis people are going to participate in.
I think it's the exact opposite, because I myself, like, I do this for a living and I'm not watching the debates because I don't see what the point is. I don't see what the point is. Why learn about these candidates and their policy positions by the time I get my say? They're not even there. So if I'm tuning it out, how are the normies doing right now? Do you think any of them are really all this into, all that into these debates and like trying to figure out which candidate represents them? Like,
they
why
rate well
waste
for
your
a television
time?
Show. They are low for debates, but they rate well for, I mean, about as many people watch them as like a good sporting event or good non-football sporting event.
Well, and that's what it feels like. It's a soundbite trading. It's not about policy. It's only political wonks that are watching. Like, it's depressing. I don't think this is helping our system to have this go on forever. And then when it's your turn to vote, like,
this is my problem with you people. And by you people, I mean systems thinkers. You know, there's this idea that, no, we just need to change this system and we're going to get the result that I want. I want to build a system that gets the result that I'm happier with. When in reality, this situation that we're in right now, it's the doth protest too much election. A lot of people say anybody but Trump and Biden until they get a choice. In that case, they're like, well,
that's precisely
Biden could probably beat Trump. And well, I like Trump before Biden got here. So like, that's just what America wants.
We're not getting choices. That's precisely my point. The Democrats.
No,
have
I think
decided,
people want. They are choosing these people.
We haven't gotten to vote on anything. So who's the we that's doing the choosing here?
Like, how many votes do you want?
Any.
Well, there is going to be one. It's going to happen in November. It's going to be a really big deal. We're going to talk about it a lot.
Yeah, and when we get our buffet of candidates, it's going to be whittled down to the point that, like, we're not really getting too many choices, are we?
Well,
like, the whole primary process is happening the year before the election, and we're not a part of it. So that's kind of my entire point, is, like, we're not getting all these choices. We're not really getting to choose who runs for, especially the Democrats. It's just Biden. They're not really doing a primary at all.
We didn't even put this on the ballot or put this on the rundown, but the Florida Democrats just removed their primary. They just said, we're only submitting by Florida law. If only one candidate is on the ballot, they just don't spend the money on the primary. And so they did not list Marianne Williamson and they didn't list Dean Phillips. And so they're just like,
but they were actively trying to get on it. They just denied them access.
And they just denied them access.
Case in point. Yeah. I mean, this is where we're headed.
Because the party establishment went, well, she's crazy. She doesn't count. Because that's pretty much what happened, right?
Because democracy is on the ballot. Well, I guess nobody's on the ballot because there was no ballot because there was only one person on there. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, that kind of stuff. I do think that I'm on your side with. I'm on your side when you are trying to actively affect the primary because you are afraid that you have a weak incumbent. I think that no matter what, if you ran that Florida primary, Joe Biden would win by probably 30 points over Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson. But you should run it, especially if you are running as the party of democracy. I'm with you there. Some of the other stuff of how long people should be staying in this race, I think we might have a difference of opinion.
Well, I mean, I think the issue is how long the race is. I don't think that people would be fighting so hard to stay in the race if it hadn't been going on for a whole year already. Like, if we started the primary on January 1st and did the votes on January 21st, you can stay in the primary. But the fact that we make it so long and so expensive is a part of the problem.
Yeah, I think in a world where you're able to buy time for anything that you want, be it on a podcast, a television show, or you're just able to draw attention by doing things. Even if you formally said no one's allowed to run before New Year's Day of an election year, you would still just have a bunch of people running shadow campaigns and influence stuff. And then the only the difference would be Doug Batman would just not register. Yeah. He would do a shadow campaign.
I would just go on
register.
Vacation in Iowa, and I would give educational speeches around Iowa about the importance of democracy and so on and so forth. And then later I would register. Yeah.
We just have a tremendous thirst for politics right now in our pop culture, which is great.
Which I think is a bad thing for the record. Like one of the things that I like,
reaping all the benefits.
So this is one of those, like, there is this like kind of interesting, oh my God, I'm finally one of these people that goes, America's not a democracy. It's a republic. Like, if we're using the lower D and the lower R, nothing to do with the parties, right? Of democracy and republic. Democracy, think active democracy where the electorate is very involved in day-to-day governance, where, you know, everybody's joining assemblies and things like that. Think ancient Greece. Republic is you elect somebody that kind of shares your values to go do the politics for me so I don't have to worry about it. And I lean towards that version. I like that version. I don't blame people that aren't plugged into politics. I think they should be living their lives. And ideally, the state should be small enough and well-run and unimportant enough that you're not involved in it day-to-day. Like when I used to, not anymore, but when I first started traveling internationally, I was always struck by the fact that when I met Canadians, occasionally they'd forget who their prime minister was, which I thought was beautiful. I'd be like, who's your prime minister? Is it still Stephen Harper? And they'd like take a beat and go, yeah, it's Stephen Harper.
I think they remember this one.
Yeah, no. Now they're all aware of Trudeau, right? But like somebody said, like the best country in the world is where you're not afraid to drink the water and you don't remember the name of the president. I think there's something to that. And I think that the size of the government, the size of the politics become bigger, then people are going to get sucked into it. And then it's going to become something that becomes a dominant part of media because it is such a big part of life. So people are paying attention to it.
Just saying. Rampant, rabid politics love is paying the mortgage on this house that we're recording in right now. So be careful what you wish for. Democracy Nuance guy writes, for my money, democracy isn't trusting the electorate to make the right decision. It's saying, let's allow the electorate to make this decision and abide by whatever we feel it's right or not.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Agreed.
Coming up with different definitions of democracy. I'm not going to fight on that. Fine.
Sounds like more words.
Yeah.
Yes, there is a politics museum in Des Moines. The State History Museum in Des Moines currently has a civics in action exhibit that features some campaign paraphernalia. So maybe something
nice.
We can do.
Maybe that's what we'll do.
Naked Attraction is available on Max.
We need to do TV night, by the way. I really want to do TV night.
I didn't even realize what it was until after this podcast.
I really want to do you two and your partners. I want to do introduce me to Veep, and yep. I'll introduce you to Naked Attraction. That's what I want to do.
First, you need a TV.
Well, we would do it over here.
Oh, yeah. So you can shoot on my career a little bit.
Yeah. Also, Justin has an open bar. I don't have an open bar.
No,
I'd rather do it over here.
Fine. Sit in my hot tub. Yeah, watch my V.
He's got a hot tub,
attack
right?
Attack me.
Hey, you're ruining democracy. You're actively eroding the republic.
Your entire
parasite
career
asshole.
Is a problem.
Anyway, can I get some coffee? Is there new? what's this coffee? It's good coffee. All indicators say the economy is awesome, says both my wife and I are currently looking for new jobs. Everyone says they're urgently hiring, but our applications are getting denied, even with what I believe are great resumes and pretty low expectations. Every week we have less money in the bank. I've heard other people with similar experiences. What's going on with this job market?
That's a complex question. I think the immediate reality is that there are multiple job markets that we lump into as the job market. And part of it depends on what you're trying to do. And part of it depends on where you are. So, and I don't have that information in front of me.
I also haven't heard a single person say they're going for a job and can't find any. Like, that's not something that in my personal anecdotes
I've
seen.
I have somebody close to me that has been throwing resumes out left and right. And, it's a lot tighter, at least in their field, than it once was, where things were very, very easy to go.
I think
places.
It depends on the job, right? So if you want to go and work in a restaurant right now, you're fine. But if you're trying to get something in a specific field, like there's changing technologies, there's changing work environments. You know, some people are work from home, some are off. Like, there's a lot of different dynamics. But if you're not trying to be in like one specific field, you can go out and get a job pretty easily. You just might not do it in.
Yeah. Cause there's a bunch of different job markets. I mean, before I did this, I was more actively involved in comedy, and like, if you want to be a late night comedy writer, there's only like maybe 40 people in the country doing that.
Yeah.
Like there's literally 40 people that are doing late night comedy writing. So I think it, like, this is not to say that your concerns are illegitimate, that what you're going through is illegitimate, you're mistaken. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just saying that like it is complex, and I think that it depends on where you're at and what you're doing.
Yeah, if I wanted to be a waitress, I can think of 5 restaurants right now I could walk in and have a job.
Okay, I want to do an episode when I have more time to do some research come the new year. I really want to do an episode comparing the American economy now to the 1950s. Because cursory research I found fascinating, where in the 50s, I think the median price of home was actually more expensive in terms of work hours people did. The median amount of home ownership was lower than it is now. By most metrics, everybody's doing, or on average and by median, people are doing better now than they were in the 50s. But the key two differences that I can spot are, the country was far less unequal in the 50s than it is now, and inequality has increased. Even if people are doing better, the gap between you and your neighbor has increased. People
economic
are aware of it.
Inequality.
Economic inequality. That's right. which I'm very much in favor of, like, raise the floor, but I don't care about the gap. I care about poverty. I don't care about the gap between people. I care about the net at the bottom. That said, though, that seems to be a part of it. And then the other bit is that if you go back to the 50s, the media apparatus was far more localized, whereas now it's completely nationalized, and media always focuses on things that are bad or scary or visceral. And there's always something scary or visceral happening in the country. And so as a result, I think that, like, I think we're living in a very odd time right now where it could actually be better than previous eras, but it feels horrible. And all of the data that we are working with as people indicates that it's very bad, even if it might be better than it would have been 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. There is certainly a phenomenon that you can track of, I'm doing well, but the economy's awful. That seems to be a more popular sentiment. But no matter how much we point to the job market or quote unquote cooling inflation, the rate of inflation, not actual inflation, there's a lot of negative economic sentiment out there. And
well, I mean, a cooling rate of inflation just means that your money is becoming worthless at a slower rate. But the rates need to go back down to where they were in order for us to feel like, oh, I can start going out to restaurants again. And
which is not happening. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to deflate back to, you know, where it was. All that inflation that happened at such a rapid rate a year ago
it's our new normal.
That's just there forever. Yeah. It's a matter of whether or not it continues to be a runaway train, and whether or not you get paid more from your job, and so therefore you can understand and appreciate these new normal prices.
Well, the standard increase at the end of the year is still a 3% raise for your cost of living, even though inflation has, like, raised food to the point that my HEB has doubled since I was here last year and I'm buying the same crap. Unless it goes back down to the prices it was before, people are going to feel that squeeze. You can tell people all day, well, inflation is less, but, like, if you're going to the grocery store and it's doubled.
Number one, that's a lie. Like, whenever anybody's like, oh, like, inflation is cooling. No, the
rate of inflation.
The rate of inflation is not
that's like so we're like, your house has caught fire by 50%, but now the part of your house that's catching fire is slowed down. Like, now it's just catching fire at a rate of 5% per day or something like that.
Do you see,
like,
that exploding house in Virginia?
No.
Dude, it is insane.
Why'd it blow up?
We don't know. We know that the police were about to execute a search warrant and then the house exploded. He was apparently a shut-in that people in the neighborhood barely saw, had tinfoil on his windows. But the explosion is out of a Michael Bay movie.
That sounds methy.
This is not a...
This is beyond meth lab into, like, small arms dealing.
You know, I don't know exactly what an exploding meth lab looks like, but
God knows I do.
But it is big. Yeah, look it up. It's
Have you guys seen the RV that's, like, burned into the ground over by Lady Bird Lake?
No.
Yeah, we drove by it the other day. We're like, what the fuck? It's, like, melted.
Oh, Jesus.
Like, this thing is gone. And it was an RV, so, like, God only knows what that story is. I was hoping you guys could tell me.
Oh, by the way, the person that yelled at us for saying that it was the landlord that lit the fire in the homeless encampment apologized and said, no, it looks pretty clear that it was a homeless guy that lit the fire. So he did apologize.
Thank you. I love it when people, because we'll admit when we're wrong. I think we're all pretty good at that. I love it when people
despite the name of this show.
Well, I mean, we're saying it ironically, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm saying it religiously.
Yeah, you would.
Well, it's the fact that we all constantly agree on everything would be evidence of that. That it's 100% consensus at all times.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
But I do love those emails where people will be like, oh, hey, like, I came at you. There was one guy that came at me on Twitter, like, demanding an apology for something and then just, like, deleted his tweets when I was just like, no, you're demonstrably fucking wrong. It's just like, just say you're sorry and I'll like you. But now you're muted and I'll never hear from you again.
Yeah.
You know, just be nice to us.
Feedback's hilarious.
Is it?
Yeah.
It can be.
No, it's great. It's great.
I think it's usually funny.
Yeah. I mean, because we're not real people to them. So we're like, it's like Barney the dinosaur cursed. And you're like,
I mean,
I have a kid here.
Even in my real life, I feel like 25% character. Like this is
you are.
As me, the guy who knows my world. I'm like, I only think I'm 75% human.
If you admitted to me right now that you came from Roger Rabbit's Toontown, I would believe it.
And when you look up basic bitch in the dictionary, you see my face.
Oh, We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Heaton, what's on the orphanage?
I've got a really interesting topic this week that I think is particularly pertinent to the holidays here. It's actually a little bit less political than usual and something that I think everybody will have traction with. My friend Chris Moody, former correspondent over at CNN, he's been gone a few years now. He and his wife moved to North Carolina. They live in the mountains up there where there's very bad cell phone reception. They had a kid about a year ago, and they felt that they were spending just too much time looking at their phones and dicking around on the internet at a very golden part of the formation of their family. And they finally had a chat about it and went, why don't we just get rid of the internet? And so they called up their internet company a year ago. And they went, we would like to install a landline because there's no cell phone reception on this mountain, and we would like you to cut loose our internet. And the internet company went, I think you've got that wrong. And they went, no, we want to install a landline like in 1992, and we want to not have any internet. And they've spent the last year where, I mean, they can drive into town. It's like 15, 20 minutes away. They still have, he works at a university. He can go in. So it's not like they're Amish or anything, but in their home,
yeah,
they don't have any internet. And it was fascinating talking to him about that, of what compelled him and his wife to do that, how it's affected their life, I should say vastly positively according to them, and just kind of thinking about the role of technology in our lives and how we can make technology work for us rather than the other way around this week on The Political Orphanage.
Sounds like child abuse with extra steps. Jen.
So I actually put up a bonus episode on Congressional Dish, which is an interview that I did on politics, politics, politics.
Indeed.
With Justin Robert Young.
Yeah.
It was such a Congress-heavy conversation. I felt like my audience would love it. And so I took just that piece. And thank you again for letting me do that. So I actually think you should listen to the entire episode of Politics, 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 which was the December 1st episode, while I work on cutting up this Ukraine hearing for my next episode. It was a fascinating one. But until then, Justin and I...
Politics, chatting politics. It up. Yeah. Good talk about where the roadmap for Congress is. By the way, two big congressional news stories. Both Patrick McHenry,
yeah,
the interim speaker,
a sane
saying
one,
that he is not going to run again.
We have a bunch of them on their way out, yeah.
And K-Mac, Kevin McCarthy, will not run.
Stop it.
He's like Santos. Why do I need to look at you people?
Please
anymore?
Tell me he's going to go push psychedelics and marijuana with the Speaker Emeritus John Boehner.
I think he is out. You know, there is a book that Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, and I forget who the third one that they wrote together called like Young Guns or Mavericks.
Was
or
it
something
Eric
like
Cantor?
That. It was probably Cantor, yeah.
Yeah.
And
was he one of the Young Guns? It was,
yes,
Cantor, Paul, yeah, Ryan, him,
and Kevin McCarthy. Yeah,
yeah,
it was
okay,
the three of them. And now they've all slowly faded, like the photo in Back to the Future. Just one by one, just the kicked out of. Getting kicked out of Congress.
It's just Kevin McCarthy trying to play a guitar.
Can't be speaker no more.
But they're leaving us with just the nuts. Like, I'm kind of sad to see Patrick McHenry in particular. Like, I disagree with him on a lot of things, but he wasn't insane. And it sounds like we're losing a lot of the.
And by the way, Mike Johnson, the current speaker, the only man in Congress with less than five enemies. Boy, has he gained them fast. turns out it's just not a popular position. A lot of people are upset with him because he's actually trying to get a deal to fund the government. So,
yeah, they had a Ukraine briefing. I think it was like last night, and the Republicans were just walking out of it immediately because the briefing on Ukraine wasn't about the border. Like, things are real bad in Congress right now.
Yeah.
I still don't know if anything's getting done.
We'll see. PX3 this week, the corrosive to our very fabric of democracy debate will be covered on Friday's episode. And
you've already done a Newsom and
DeSantis
recap,
I
right?
Because
I need to listen to that.
Oh, that was on the episode with Jen,
me.
I believe. So you can listen to my breakdown of the DeSantis-Newsom debate on Friday, but the Vivek Ramaswamy, Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, and Chris Christie. Slipped in under the wire, which I think he can only do metaphorically.
And I'm sure by the time you vote, he won't be on the ballot. So
he will. No, he'll be on in Iowa. He's all in for New Hampshire.
That makes sense.
So he is going to stay in through Iowa. He'll get his ass kicked in Iowa, and then he'll do whatever he does in New Hampshire. But he will likely drop out at that point.
He seems like someone that would really thrive at a pancake breakfast.
Yeah.
Boy, would he.
Yeah.
Boy, would he. That's on PX3. Till next time. This is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, for Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, saying we're not wrong. Biblically.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.
Biblically.
Yeah, because you said facetiously. Yeah. I'm saying scripture.
I don't even think I can pronounce facetiously.
Jen, you can't argue with that. Scripture, sorry.
Yeah.
Them's the rules. We're in Texas.